council for being here promptly at 9:45, and apologies for the court not being here promptly at 9:45. We'll call 99-1329, Tricia A. Taylor versus Great Way Insurance Company. James H. Fowler representing Tricia A. Taylor. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is, you've already indicated, is James H. Fowler. I represent Tricia Taylor, who is here today in court and seated behind me, and also with me is my co-counsel, Attorney Todd Daniel from Janesville, Wisconsin. Chief Justice Abramson, Honorable Justices of the Supreme Court, Counsel, may it please the Court. As an introduction to the petition for review and to the petitioner's brief in this case, I offered a table that was designed to describe the functioning of the American family policies that are at issue in this case. I believe at one point in my brief I referred to that as a picture, and borrowing on a popular puzzle question, I asked the legal equivalent of what's wrong with that picture. From the petitioner's perspective, hers is one of an individual who has suffered a loss of the most grievous kind, and having purchased insurance, the injury of the most grievous kind was caused by someone who had purchased insurance, which was inadequate to compensate for the damages that she sustained. Upon making a claim based upon those policies, she was told by her carrier that there was no coverage. Hers is not the only perspective, of course. American Family takes the position that its policies should be interpreted by this court to determine that there is, in fact, no underinsured motorist coverage. The question, therefore, is before you for a decision as to whether or not the policies that are at issue in this case provide underinsured motorist coverage in regard to those injuries.
Are you saying underinsured motorist coverage?
Yes, Judge.
Okay.
Justice Wilcox.
Now, just a question to start this out. You and opposing counsel stipulated to the fact that this was an unambiguous definition, at least of underinsurance. Is that correct?
Justice Wilcox, I have taken a position in my argument based on the Smith holding. I tried to take the most conservative.
Smith versus Alaina, which is the.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. I've tried to take the most conservative position I could in determining how to frame the issues in this case. I'm not aware of any decision of this court or any of the court of appeals that have held that particular language defining what is an underinsured motor vehicle to be ambiguous. So I have proceeded on that assumption. I would mention, however, that I think the issue goes farther than that, and that the thrust of this case is my position that the court should consider other language in the policy, in fact, all of the language in the policy, in determining whether or not that definition, in conjunction with the reducing clause, creates an illusion of coverage. So the short answer to your question is yes, subject to those comments.
Okay. So the clause in the insurance policy talks about underinsured motor vehicle means that a motor vehicle which is insured, and I'll skip over some of this, by a liability bond or policy at the time, the limits are less than the limits of the liability of this underinsured motorist coverage. So in this case, just to set the scenario, the person, the tortfeasor, Mr. Hermanson, had a $50,000 policy, and your client had a $50,000 underinsured. His was an underinsured clause. And then there was a reducing clause that said whatever the tortfeasor pays, it would be reduced by that amount.
That's correct, Judge, except there were two policies,
yes,
of course.
Right.
But they had the
but
same
you line. Didn't argue, but, and that's another question, we're looking at these policies separately or together?
I have, again, based my position on the Kretsch case, which says that the first question to take up is whether or not the policies compared individually against the liability policy would provide coverage, and I have based my position on that analysis.
So, from this court, then your what precedent are you relying on, in looking beyond the, as you indicated, the unambiguous definition that's in the policy? What would you like?
Judge, what I pointed out in my brief is, first of all, the Hoagland case that had an absolutely, or at least as unambiguous a definition of underinsured motorist coverage as does this policy. They're almost the same.
But wasn't the policy, I was going to say, the policy language different in Hoagland and in Meyer than it is in this case and perhaps in the Smith case?
I would suggest, Justice Wilcox, that no, that the essentials of the definition of an underinsured motor vehicle are essentially the same in Hoagland and in Smith 2 and in the other case that you cited. In other words, underinsured motor vehicle in both policies is defined as one that has liability limits less than the limits of the underinsured motorist coverage. I believe that's the essential of the definition, and those essentials were the same in both cases.
One was $25,000 and this was $50,000.
Correct. The limits were different. I pointed out in my briefs that there were two basic defects in the operation of these American Family policies. One, of course, was that as Tricia Taylor increased the limits of her coverage from $25,000 to $50,000, the net effect of that was to erase her coverage entirely, down to zero. It seems to me that that is an illusion of coverage, that any reasonable insured would interpret it that way and would never expect to bargain for such a result.
Is it in the record that she originally had a $25,000 underinsured policy?
No, it is not.
So then I guess you're arguing that hypothetically a person that had a $25,000 policy under the Hoagland case would be able to recover $25,000. But if he or she increased that limit to $50,000, instead of recovering $25,000, they would recover zero.
That's correct, Justice Babich, and that's what the table was designed to represent. That's true.
What consequence, if any, is that effective date, I think of October 1995, if I remember correctly, changing the $25,000 to the $50,000 limit?
Justice Bradley, this accident occurred in 1993, which was prior to the effective date of the 1995 legislation, so I've taken the position that that 1995 legislation is not relevant to this case. Period.
Let me make sure I understand your argument. We have here a conceitedly unambiguous definition of underinsured motorist. Is that correct?
The definition, the two-line definition, I have taken the position consistent with Smith is unambiguous.
If it is unambiguous, what legal authority do you rely on to go beyond the unambiguous definition set forth in the contract?
Justice Bradley, the definition in Hoagland was just as unambiguous. And if that logic had been followed, the court would have stopped at the definition, regardless of the fact that the limits were $25,000 on each policy. There would have been no need to go beyond that.
What? I note in last term the Dauhauer case. That wasn't cited in your briefs because I think it was not released until after your briefs were due.
One day after, as a matter of fact.
The Dauhauer case dealt with underinsured motorists, if I remember correctly. The Dauhauer case also had an unambiguous statute, and I think found the language to be unambiguous. Nevertheless, it proceeded to look at the statute and the provisions of the policy in context. What, if any, guidance is there from the Dauhauer case to this case?
Justice Bradley, the reducing clause in Dauhauer, which was the focus of that case, was just as unambiguous as the definition of an underinsured motor vehicle in the Taylor case. The court in that case chose to consider not only that unambiguous language, not to stop there, but to look at the policy, in essence, from cover to cover, and to make the determine what would an insured, a human being, a layperson, make out of that policy. Where in that policy would a non-attorney person find out about the fact that the reducing clause was there and have any idea as to what the effect of that reducing clause might be? And in making that determination, the court held that it should start with the description of the coverage, underinsured motorist coverage. It should look at the limits which were set forth altogether, liability, underinsured motorist, uninsured motorist, medical payments. It should look at the gloss language in the policy, and I pointed to some of that language in this particular case, and if the court will recall, language on the second page of this policy indicates that we will insure you for the coverages and the limits of liability as shown in the declarations of this policy. That's the second page of this policy.
Counsel?
Yes, Judge.
I was just looking at the Dauhauer case, and as I recall, and I'm reading on page paragraph 35, that this court said, we recognize that a reducing clause may be ambiguous within the context of the insurance contract. If the terms of the policy are ambiguous, then the court may attempt to determine what a reasonable person in the position of the insured would have understood the words of the policy to mean. So, as I take it, that's really not the issue here, because here, if, and this is why I asked the preliminary question, both parties agree that the clause is unambiguous. In other words, we're talking about, in one case, ambiguity, and then we sent that case back to the trial court. Some five of the members said, well, it could be ambiguous, and two members, Justice Prosser and Sykes, I'm reading from the case, found the contract unambiguous as it relates to the reducing clause. That's not the case here.
Yes, it is.
It is the case?
Yes, for this reason. The key words in the phrase that you cited to me are in context. That means to me, consistent with the concurrences in that case, that what the court needs to look at is not just what the two lines mean, the two lines say that consist of the reducing clause, but to take a look at the entire policy as a whole to see what the other language in that policy says about whether or not the limits would be reduced, and that only by taking a look at the entire policy can the court determine whether the concept of a reducing clause is ambiguous. It doesn't depend only on the two lines that consist of that clause.
Do you want us to rewrite the contract because it's perhaps against public policy? Is that what you're asking this court to do?
Judge, I've indicated that this court has construed a lot of insurance policies, and most often the first head note is, in the cases, is that policies are construed according to certain well-understood rules. One is that unambiguous language is not to be rewritten. But another one is that the court is required and does seek to construe insurance policies in an effort to find out what the reasonable expectations are of the insured. So those are competing considerations, obviously. And I think that those can be borne in mind in determining whether or not the two clauses that are at issue here, the definition and the reducing clause, create an illusion of coverage. And I also think that consistent with Dauhauer, they could be determined to be ambiguous when construed together with the entire policy language. And let me explain why I feel that way. In all of the cases that have talked about illusions of coverage, the court has consistently held its understanding that the purpose of UIM coverage is to compensate an injured party where the limits of liability of the tortfeasor are inadequate to do so. That's been a consistent holding from Wood 10 years ago all the way through Kuhn, through Sweeney, and into Dauhauer. The court has also held that insureds understand that to be the case, that human beings who buy these policies believe justifiably that when they are promised $50,000 of limits of underinsured motorist coverage along with $50,000 of limits of liability and the other types of coverages, that they're entitled under at least some set of circumstances to receive those limits. And that when that can't occur, as it cannot occur in this situation, that is an illusion of coverage.
Well, it all depends, and this is what it depends upon what the tortfeasor had for insurance. So if it's 50, 100, it could be $1 million. And if you had a underinsured clause that said, I'm buying $1 million underinsured, and then it had a reducing clause, they're all, what I'm saying is that in Wisconsin, of course, you have to have 25,000 insurance, but if you were driving this same car in Florida, you'd have this coverage, and you hit a driver from, I'll just pick a state, Kansas, I don't know, but had a lesser limit, it's always reducing. In other words, you start out with whatever your coverage is, 50, 100, 500,000. It's always reduced by what the liability of the tortfeasor, in this case, Hermanson. So I guess I'm going to ask the question then, what would a reasonable person reading this policy think that there was coverage under these facts? In other words, here you had somebody with 50,000. You could just change the facts and say it was 100 or 200 or 300. But what I think you're saying is that you get the 50, and then the reasonable person would have thought that they should add on whatever the underinsurance was. Is that what you're...
Yes, Judge, yeah. For this reason. I've said that the court has found illusions of coverage when it has compared its consistent holding that insurance customers believe that they are purchasing insurance that's designed to compensate them for injuries that aren't covered, and compares that with how the writer of the policy believes its policy should function. I'm sorry, Judge.
Thank you. I look at the reducing clause, and the reducing clause, at least at first glance to me, appears to be unambiguous. In essence, it says the limits of liability of this coverage will be reduced by a payment made by any person legally liable. Now here, that language seems very clear. What is it that you are claiming is illusory?
Well, Judge, that was the issue that the Kuhn Court addressed when it talked about the reducing clause, and also the Sweeney Court. It indicated that it started with the proposition that a person, when they buy underinsured motorist coverage, understands that that's to pay them for damages that aren't covered by the liability limits. Why is that? I think it's common sense. When a person buys liability coverage, they think about what am I insuring against, my possible exposure to hurting somebody else? When would I be underinsured?
If I may interrupt, counsel. I thought you might rely in your argument, and maybe you don't, on the statement in Dauhauer that says that essentially the policy must clearly set forth that the insurance, that the insured is purchasing a level of underinsured that will be arrived at by combining payments from all sources. And I thought your argument might be, and if it's not, it's fine, that this policy simply doesn't do that. That the that this language, this limit of liability, is buried in the policy in context. It's it just doesn't follow the dictates of Dauhauer. Now, why is that not your argument? Or if it is, could you expand on it and tell us why the policy doesn't say that clearly?
Judge, I think the Dauhauer argument is certainly an alternative argument, as was earlier pointed out. That case was not available to me when I drew these briefs.
But it has been for some time.
It has, yes. And I think it is an alternative argument, and I think both positions, that this policy language creates an illusion of coverage pursuant to Kuhn and Sweeney, or results in an ambiguity pursuant to Dauhauer, arise from the basic fundamental conclusion of the courts over the years that insureds believe that the purpose of UIM coverage is to pay for damages that the tortfeasor policy doesn't cover. Both theories arise out of that simple set of circumstances. Whether you call it an ambiguity and proceed on the Dauhauer type of analysis, you go through the policy cover to cover and see what else is in there. And I brought the policy with me and I can do that, but I'm down to a couple of minutes.
Well, do you think this your policy looks like or is similar to, in context, to the Dauhauer policy?
Justice Abrahamson, I haven't seen the Dauhauer policy. Apparently it had a number of endorsements, 7 or 8 as I recall reading the decision. This policy doesn't. It has 2. It's got the preparatory language in terms of limits, the promise to pay those limits. Later in the policy, it talks about the limit for each person is the maximum of all damages sustained by the person, and that the policy will pay that, that it will pay the maximum. And later on the next page, begins to talk about reducing those limits.
Your policy is in, at least part of the policy is in your appendix. Is the whole policy in the file?
It is, Judge.
Pardon?
It's part of the record.
Okay, it's part of the record. And you know, of course, that the Dauhauer holding was that there was no substantive due process, but that I think it was 5 members of this court sent this back for a determination on ambiguity, or at least what a reasonable person might expect, a reasonable insurer might expect.
Yes, Judge.
Do you believe that insurance contracts are controlled by the same rules of construction that apply to other contracts?
Yes, I do.
Okay. See? All right.
And I believe, Judge, that in this case, that in order to proceed into the policy beyond language that can be regarded as unambiguous, that there has to be something else. And in my brief, I have identified that something else, and that's an illusion of coverage, a policy that makes the limits unavailable under any circumstances and reduces those limits, the limits of coverage, as the UIM limits are raised.
Yeah, when you say any circumstances, I have your chart here, and I was using an example as used by the Court of Appeals in their concurring opinion about 18 states have lower limits than the state of Wisconsin. But basically, when one doesn't know who you're going to run into or who's going to run into you, how is that illusory if the limit is lower than 50,000?
In Kuhn, Judge, the court said that losing a part of your limits is a species of an illusion. Whether you lose them all or lose a part of it, it's still illusory coverage. And, of course, that holding was brought forward into the Sweeney decision, that it's just as much an illusion if you lose half your limits as if you lose all of them.
What if this policy under the coverage, under the underinsured motorist coverage, what if it went on to say, subject to a reduction pursuant to whatever clause that is, subject to the reduction found on page,
you know, the reducing...
Reducing clause.
Yeah, for the reducing clause. Would that be sufficient? Would you be here today if that...
I'm sorry, just where would that language occur?
Right on the cover sheet, where it says, underinsured motorist coverage, bodily injury only, $50,000 each person, $100,000 each accident, and then in bold print or something, the policy said, subject to the reducing clause found on page whatever.
It would make a substantial difference in whether an ordinary person who, I think the Dalhauer case recognized, at least reads the limits page, would that draw their attention to that language? Probably it ought to.
Counsel, I still don't understand your argument about why we get to the reducing clause at all in this case, and an analysis of whether the operation of the reducing clause renders the coverage in this policy illusory, because by operation of the definition of uninsured or underinsured motorist, there is no coverage in the first place, so why should we analyze whether it's illusory or not?
Well, Justice Sykes, I cited the Hoagland case and the Rohde case as examples of where a court had the same definition and proceeded beyond it for a reason. And the reason was that there was an affront to public policy shown in those and later on in the policy. Thank you.
Does that mean we have to overrule the Smith versus Atlantic case?
No, Judge. I think that if you broaden Smith and rule that you will not focus on two lines in the policy, the definition, but we'll look at that definition in the context of the rest of the policy and what effect that would have on a reasonable insured, that you can easily and should hold that these policies provide coverage.
Did Smith specifically address the issue of illusory coverage?
It did not, Judge.
What is the total amount that you are claiming that Mrs. Taylor is entitled to?
Just as possible, the trial court awarded her $50,000 on each policy, which would be consistent with the Meyer decision, and that is what we are seeking in this case. That would be consistent with the cases where an illusion of coverage was found, that the policy would be read in conformity with the reasonable expectations of the customer, which in this case we assert would be the $50,000 limits of UIM coverage.
Why do you think you're entitled to both policies?
Well, Judge, it's been stipulated in the record that if we prevail in respect to a determination that either policy would afford coverage, that they would stack under 631.43.
Thank you, Counsel. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Is it Plano or Plymouth?
It's Plano, Justice. Good morning. May it please the Court, David Pliner, appearing on behalf of American Family Mutual Insurance Company. One of the final questions posed to counsel is really the heart of our argument in this case, and that is, why do we even get to the reducing clause in the first place? And it is our position that, in fact, the plaintiff petitioner is asking this Court to overrule Smith and all of the subsequent Court of Appeals decisions that said that once you determine there is no coverage in the first instance by virtue of the unambiguous definition of underinsured motor vehicle, you do not go beyond that definition to determine if some other provision of the policy would be ambiguous or would create illusory coverage if, under a hypothetical situation, there was coverage. It is our position, by way of analogy, that what the plaintiffs are essentially arguing is that if I file a motion for summary judgment and I prevail on the grounds that there is no coverage in the first instance, the court then has the authority to, for example, look to a policy exclusion, which the court believes the insurance company may have raised as an alternative defense if there had been coverage, and say, well, if that exclusion had come up and if there had been coverage, that exclusion is invalid for whatever reason, and therefore, we're going to say that there is coverage.
Well, do you think that Dalhauer overruled Smith sub silentio?
I do not think it does justice. As I read Dalhauer,
distinguish Dalhauer, because as I understand it, the language in Dalhauer was very, very similar, if not completely the same, as the language here.
As I read Dalhauer, Justice, I don't believe the question of whether there was underinsured motorist coverage in the first place was at issue. I may be wrong about that, but I don't think that was a question. I think the whole issue was whether the reducing clauses, number one, whether the statute was constitutional that permits such clauses, and number two, whether it created illusory coverage. That's consistent with our position, that if there is coverage, then you can look at these other provisions and see if they apply and see if they're enforceable.
Counsel, in Dalhauer, the language of the policy was considered unambiguous. Is that correct?
My understanding is that I don't
It
know.
Wasn't contested. It wasn't argued. The words meant what they said in the Dalhauer case. That's the way the majority treated the language. Is that correct?
That's my understanding, Justice, as to the definition of underinsured motor vehicle.
And yet, referring to paragraph 35, as Justice Wilcox did, the holding of the majority was that we recognize that a clause may be ambiguous with, it says, we recognize that a reducing clause may be ambiguous within the context of the insurance contract. So even though you have language that is clear, language, this is a car. Yeah. That's clear language. But in the context of the entire contract, it may be ambiguous. So the Dalhauer court took unambiguous policy language, but said it could be rendered ambiguous in the context of the insurance contract, and then remanded for the trial court to determine what a reasonable person in the position of the insured would have understood the words of the policy to mean. So to me, explain to me why I'm wrong in this. That sets up the framework. You know, I don't care about, I shouldn't say I don't care about. There may be numerous court of appeals or prior court decisions that can be advanced by either side for in support of your positions, and that's what these briefs are. Yet, just a few months ago, this court in Dalhauer set up the framework that even if you have language that everyone agrees says what it says, that in the context of the insurance contract, it can be rendered ambiguous, and therefore we have to see what a reasonable person in the position of the insured would have understood the words of the policy to mean. So to me, that's the framework that we set up 4 months ago. Why shouldn't we follow that framework?
My belief, Justice, is that the reasoning of Dalhauer in that respect can be analogized to the reasoning of the Hoagland case and the other cases counsel cited, where the courts did look beyond the definition, and also can be tied into the tension that counsel referenced between applying the standard rules of contract construction versus the reasonable expectations of the insured, and it requires a bit of an explanation. But all of the cases that were cited by the plaintiff petitioner in which the court did not just stay with the unambiguous definition involved situations where the definition itself was either illegal because it violated a statute that specifically said you cannot have this in your policy.
Well, but counsel, my question really is not the cases cited by your opposing counsel, because he acknowledges he didn't cite Dalhauer. My question is, didn't this court set up a framework 4 months ago that said that, in essence, is that even if you have language that there's, you know, this is a car that's clear, that it can be rendered ambiguous in the context of the contract, then we look to what a reasonable insured would consider. Page 125 of the Dalhauer opinion says, we believe that a reasonable insured expects to be protected against a loss caused by another that is not covered by the underinsured driver's liability coverage at the page 128. The opinion discusses Kuhn and Wood, and again discusses what a reasonable insured would understand. UIM coverage is effective where there is a tortfeasor with liability coverage inadequate in amount for the injuries caused. A lot of this opinion discusses reasonable insured standard and then sends it back to the trial court to apply. So should we negate the framework we established 4 months ago?
I have two responses to that, Justice. The first is that I believe there is a significant distinction between the Dauhauer situation and our situation. The reducing clauses in Dauhauer, as the reducing clauses in many of the other cases that have been cited, would operate to effectively preclude the insured from ever obtaining their full UIM limits on top of the liability limits. The reason that's important is because that is one of the only situations where the courts have gone beyond an unambiguous definition and said we're going to look to the reasonable expectations of the insured test. In this case, and the plaintiff has taken the position in this case that there are that she could never receive the full UIM limits.
Okay.
That is not correct.
I'm a little slower than you are in terms of the analysis. So you're saying Dauhauer is distinguished because the reducing clause in Dauhauer would negate the policyholder ever being able to reach the limits? Is that what you said?
Ever being able to obtain the full UIM limits that were paid for over and above the available liability limits.
And that distinguishes from this case how? Here you have the argument that they can't get any of the limits. I mean, that's what the result is, right?
Well, it's under the facts of this case because the liability policy had the same limits, that's true. But if we look just at the definition of underinsured motor vehicle, it's not true. For example, if the tortfeasor had liability limits of $25,000, Ms. Taylor would be entitled to the full $50,000 UIM limits. And the reason I think Dauhauer is distinguishable is because every case that I have found that talks about coverage being illusory talks about situations where the insured can never get either all or some part of their coverage. And that is viewed as being such a significant concern that it takes precedence over the standard rules of contract construction, which say we do not go beyond an unambiguous policy term. Since we do not have that problem of illusoriness here, I believe the framework used in Dauhauer is distinguishable. I would also address, if I may, the concept of the reasonable expectations of the insured. I think it is correct as a general proposition and a general statement to say that a reasonable insured believes the purpose of underinsured motorist coverage is to provide excess coverage over and above the liability limits. It is also just as true to say that someone who buys a liability policy expects to be covered if they're at fault in an accident. Those are both true general statements taken in a vacuum, but there's no authority for the idea that insurance companies cannot, with clear and unambiguous language, impose certain restrictions and qualifications and limitations on the scope of that coverage or on the very existence of that coverage.
I guess that's part of the problem here. Let me, if I may, just set aside the nuances of the many cases cited and say that, look, I'm an average policyholder and I want underinsured coverage. So what do? The students will understand this. What do? You go to the computer and you put underinsured motorist coverage. And that's what I want. Enter. And you get a list of things. And you get, at the top of the list is insured.com. So what's underinsured motorist coverage? Well, underinsured motorist coverage
will pay out if the driver who hits you causes more damage than his or her liability coverage can cover. That's what you just said you concede is the, I think you said, the reasonable insured would believe, and that's in fact what Dauhauer said too.
Yes, right? As a general statement.
Okay, so what, this is my problem with this case. What do I do when that's my understanding of what underinsured motorist coverage is? That's what the Dauhauer case says. That's what people think underinsured motorist coverage is. That's what you indicate, that that's what reasonable people think underinsured motorist coverage is. But ha-ha, in this policy, not just this company, but other companies, I would assume, we're going to define it differently. We're going to say it isn't what insured.com says, it isn't what Dauhauer says, it isn't what you think the reasonable insured would say, but we're going to define it that it is, covers liability at the time of the accident, which provides bodily injury liability limits less than the limits of liability of this underinsured motorist coverage. We're going to give a definition that's not the common definition. So that it, we're going to give a definition that is contrary to what the reasonable insured would understand. That's a problem to me. When that's my problem with this case, because it's like, look, you talked about liability insurance. I'm going to buy liability insurance. I am Josephine policyholder. Liability insurance covers me when I'm liable for an accident, okay? When it's in part my fault. So I buy it. Let's say in the provision of the policy on page 15 that it says, but only if the accident happens after between 9 and 12 on Fridays. It's clear. No one in this courtroom would say those words are unclear. They are clear and unambiguous, but they sure are contrary to what every reasonable policyholder would find in talking with one another, in the concession that you made, and looking at Dauhauer and going on the internet. So, don't we have a problem here? When the contract, I mean, you can contract and have clear language, but if it's so clearly inconsistent with what the reasonable policyholder expects, then it seems we have a problem. Now, tell me where I'm wrong with that.
Justice, I can only analogize to the situation where I think one could reasonably say that an average insurer doesn't necessarily anticipate or expect that there will be certain exclusions in the policy either. For example, this policy contains an exclusion, American Families does, for UIM coverage if the injuries arise while the insured vehicle is being used to carry persons for a charge. Someone who takes out a UIM policy with a general understanding of what UIM coverage is not going to anticipate or suspect that that exclusion is in there, or that any particular exclusion is in there, unless they look at it. It's not on the declaration.
But this goes to, what I'm talking about goes to the essence of the animal. You know, what is under insurance? It's what you concede people would think it would be. It's what Dauhauer says what people think it would be. It's what you punch, first thing you punch when you get in the computer, and you're saying, oh no, we're going to define it as limits less than the liability limits of this underinsured. Would ever think that's the definition, unless you read the words, and that's your response. You got to read the words of the contract. Or what do you do when the words of the contract are contrary to what the reasonable person would expect?
Is it?
Justice Lopez.
No, I was just going to say that in the Dauhauer opinion that we have asked you about up here, in paragraph 34, it talks about the rules for interpreting insurance contracts, and as Justice Babbage, who wrote this opinion, said they're well established. And would you just comment, and I after listening to what is reasonable, and apparently that's what this court may, one person may think is reasonable, somebody else may not, but when the terms of an insurance policy are plain on their face, the policy must not be rewritten by construction. That's in paragraph 34. Now, opposing counsel was asked this question by Justice Babich. He said, well, if the language, the reducing clause language, was put right next to the underinsured language, then would this be acceptable? And I may have I don't want to misinterpret your answer, so you have rebuttal, but I believe you said, yes, that would be better. So if the language is here, but the placement of the language may not be as a reasonable person thinks it ought to be. Is that something we should be talking about, saying?
I don't know that issue has been raised, so I haven't really thought about it prior to today. I can only say that applying the standard rules of contract construction, if the placement of that definition is in some way creates ambiguity, then I think we would have to say the placement of every exclusion in the policy creates an ambiguity if it isn't on the declarations page. And again, I realize in Dauhauer that is the issue as to whether or not the reducing clause is ambiguous by virtue of its placement. But again, I would distinguish that on the grounds that there is the potential for illusory coverage in Dauhauer, a situation where the insured will never get their full limits. And I just reiterate that in all of the cases that have gone beyond the unambiguous policy definitions, they've done so only in situations where the definition is either illegal or where it does create illusory coverage. In other words, as counsel correctly noted, there is this ongoing tension between the application of the general rules of contract versus what he believes are the reasonable expectations in the insured. And so far, the courts have said we will subsume the rules of contract to the reasonable expectations analysis if the unambiguous language creates illusory coverage such that the plaintiff is paying for something they can never get, because that obviously is a significant concern. That is not present here, and that would be the distinction that I see between the placement of the definition of underinsured motor vehicle in this case versus the possible problems with the placement of the reducing clause in Dauhauer.
Well, I've been looking at the policy and comparing it with what Dauhauer said about the policy there. And I'm getting most of this from the concurring opinion. You've got a policy that runs maybe 30 pages, roughly. Is that right?
I'll accept that. I don't have the policy.
I may be off by a couple of pages because of the numbering that's used here. And on the declaration page, I think that's what they call this, it says coverages and limits, and it says uninsured motorists, 50,000 each person, 100,000. And then it says here, it has, sort of like Dauhauer, it has a table of contents, and it has liability coverage, and it has uninsured motorist coverage. It doesn't have, and obviously I'm reading it more quickly than I, as a policyholder, would read it if I were carefully examining it at home, which of course I wouldn't do until I had an accident, right? I don't see on a quick read, but maybe you know, if there's any limit of liability here for underinsured motorist shows. And then when I get to page 29, which really I think may be 24, 5 here, we get the underinsured motorist coverage endorsement, which says keep with the policy. And then we get to your exclusions, et cetera, and that may be on the next page, et cetera. So I think that an argument might be made under Dalhauer that that's not good enough for policy. And you disagree with that argument?
Yes, Justice.
Because you can't put everything on the first page. If you put everything on the first page, you wouldn't need the other 29 of them.
That's my position, and I can, again, elaborate on that very briefly. There may, again, be exceptions to that rule when we have an illusory coverage situation. Again, that's that balancing act between the competing tensions. I don't think we have that problem with this definition.
I wonder if the whole illusory issue is just gone with that statutory amendment that said you can have reducing clauses.
The question of illusoriness may be, I think, the issue of ambiguousness is what this court remanded to determine.
In Dalhauer?
That's my understanding.
They don't ever use the word illusory in Dalhauer. I mean, I'm sorry, I can't say that. But not in this part of the opinion. They talk about it ambiguous. That is, that it could be ambiguous in context so that an oral argument, Dalhauer argued that before considering the constitutional issue, that's the substantive issue is whether that reducing statute is okay.
Sure.
The threshold question should be whether the reducing clause in the West Bend policy is ambiguous. Five members remand to consider whether it is. Two members, Justice Prosser and Sykes, find the contract unambiguous. And Justice Bradley and I concurred in sending it back, although we said, hey, we think there's a real problem with this, as I reread these cases. So it seems to me your position is that this is clear as a bell in context.
Right? Essentially applying the rules of contract construction, yes.
Counsel, I just wanted to, in paragraph 22 of Dalhauer, it talks about it mentions illusory several times, and it talks about this court, as well as the Court of Appeals, has previously considered various elements of the UIM insurance contracts, such as the definition of uninsured motorist and whether a reducing clause results in illusory coverage. It goes on to say, while reducing clauses have in some instances rendered UIM coverage illusory, we have not held that reducing clauses are per se contrary to public policy. And I think the Chief Justice was also saying, well, now there's been a statutory amendment which says, yes, you can have reducing clauses. So it did refer to illusory, the concept of whether or not the contract would be illusory coverage.
I guess one point in addition that I have is that, and this is in reference to the chart that counsel has prepared, I think the logical problem with that is that it presupposes that in Hoagland, the liability limit and the UIL limit were both $25,000, the statutory minimum. Applying the reasoning of Hoagland to this case under those facts, if Ms. Taylor had a $50,000 UIM policy and the tortfeasor had the $25,000 limit, she would still get her $50,000 UIM limits. In other words, the problem that counsel is identifying is not that Ms. Taylor increased her premium, thereby reducing her coverage. The problem is that this particular tortfeasor happened to have higher UIM or higher liability limits.
I think you misspoke, counsel, or else I misheard. You said she would still get her $50,000. She'd actually get $25,000, right? On each policy.
If we get to the reducing clause, that's correct.
Yeah, she would have received $25,000 from the tortfeasor, and then the $50,000 would be reduced by that $25,000 so that she would get $25,000.
That's correct. And I guess my point is that though the definition of underinsured motor vehicle itself would not create that result, that would come from the reducing clauses. And certainly if Ms. Taylor had $100,000 of UIM limits, paid the extra premium for that, and the liability limits were $50,000, she'd get the benefit of that extra premium and get the $100,000 subject to any reducing clause, but again, the underinsured motorist vehicle definition would not accomplish that result.
Just as a matter of sort of dialogue between you and me, why don't insurance companies put this right up front and make it clear that you're not getting $50,000, even though the declaration page says $50,000. You're not going to get $100,000, even if the declaration page says $100,000. Why not make it clear to the consumer that what you're really getting is $50,000 or $100,000, less what other people pay you? Why not put that right up front instead of burying it in little language in the back of the insurance contract?
I believe part of the problem, Justice, is knowing where to stop and where to draw the line.
I'm sorry?
I think part of the problem with that is knowing where to stop and where to draw the line in terms of what we take out of the policy and put on the declarations page. There may be several different provisions in the policy that operate to reduce the limits for one reason or another. If all of those perhaps could be put on the declaration page, but then the next logical argument would be, well, wait a minute, why don't we put some of these other definitions?
Well, maybe we should, but just for this one, it just seems such an easy thing to do, to make it clear to the consumer.
Just to take this one particular definition, put it on the declarations page.
Not even a definition, just say subject to reduction is found on page so-and-so.
Certainly, physically, it would be possible. We could also do the same by putting on references to subject to any exclusions in the policy. It would still then either everything would have to be on the declarations page or the insured would have to look at the policy to see what the qualifications and limitations were.
So you could put an asterisk and then in bold, note, these amounts might not be paid. You have to read all 30 pages.
Well, you have to read those provisions of the policy that specifically apply to this type of coverage.
No, but that would cover all of them, not only the underinsured. It would cover uninsured. It would cover liability. I mean, there are just loads of exceptions in this, you know. You gave one about the dollar amounts.
That's true. Essentially, it would be akin to putting a statement on the declarations page that you should read your policy to confirm what all of your rights or obligations or limitations are. I don't have our declaration page in front of me. I don't know if there's anything
like
that.
Yeah, you do have the first words in bold says, please read your policy. That's immediately under American Family Mutual Insurance Amendment.
Yes, and I think putting anything else comparable to that on the declarations page would essentially serve the same purpose, but it would still require the insured to go to the policy.
But I think Justice Babich's comment was that if you just have some small notation, then you're not disagreeing with that, correct? Just reduce by.
I take it this is the declaration policy that we're talking about, the one that I'm showing you that's on page 134 of the appendix.
That's the declaration page, right?
But let me take the time here and go over each one of these. The first dollar figure that appears on this declaration page is bodily injury liability of $50,000 for each person, $100,000 for each occurrence. Is that subject to any reduction clause?
I do not know if it is.
You haven't read the policy?
I've read the policy. I don't have it in front of me. I didn't study that particular part of it.
Well, it's not, is it, counsel? That's not subject. I mean, if somebody gets hurt, they're going to get $50,000 or $100,000.
Under the liability provision?
Yes.
I would expect so.
Okay. So that's not subject to reduction. Medical expense, $10,000. Is that subject to any reduction?
None that I'm aware of.
Okay.
But subrogation?
Subrogation.
Then we come to uninsured motorist, $50,000 or $100,000. Is that subject to reduction?
If
somebody doesn't have insurance, mm-hmm. I will collect $50,000 or up to $50,000.
Correct.
So the only one that's subject to reduction on this entire page is underinsured motorist coverage. Is that correct?
I would think that's probably accurate, yes.
Counsel, you think that's probably accurate looking at the declaration page, but if you turn the page and get the table of contents, you will know that there are limits of liability on each of the things that Justice Babbage asked about, with the exception of underinsured motorists, the very kind of coverage we have here. The page that sets out all of the contents of the policy has part one, liability coverage, additional definitions, blah, 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 limits of liability. Part two, medical expense coverage, a few other things, gives the limitation on liability. Part three, uninsured motorist coverage, gives the limitations on liability. That's a subheading. Look at page three. Part four, car damage coverage, payments of loss, additional definitions, additional payments, limits of liability. Part five, emergency road service coverage. Part six, general provisions. Although liability coverage, medical expense coverage, uninsured motorist coverage, and collision, car damage coverage, all indicate in the table of contents there are limits to the liability, there is nothing in the table of contents, let alone on the declaration page, there is nothing in the table of contents that would have a policyholder saying, there is something to limit the liability of underinsured. Why isn't there, when there's on the table of contents, something to trigger the policyholder to say, oh, there's a limitation on my liability on liability coverage, or there's a limit of my liability on medical expense coverage, or uninsured motorist coverage, or car damage coverage, but nothing to let the reader know that someplace in this policy is going to be a limit of the liability coverage set forth in the declaration page? Why is that?
I think, Justice, as a practical matter, the reason it's not in the table of contents of the policy itself is because the UIM coverage is added as an endorsement. It's not a part of the actual policy per se, the standard policy, and it isn't really feasible to put that in there in a standard form policy because one may choose not to purchase underinsured motor vehicle coverage.
But you could put, as Justice Babbage was pursuing, on the declaration page, check for limits of liability on coverages and check endorsements so the reader knows that may. Otherwise, how is any reader to know unless they get to one of the last pages of this document that maybe there's some liability on a definition, a limit of liability, on a definition that's contrary to what a reasonable insured would think. How is the average person to know that? How is the average reasonable person to know that?
I can only say that I believe a reasonable person looking at the declarations page would see, number one, that UIM coverage was added by endorsement, and they have this, I don't know, two or three page attachment to the policy that is the UIM endorsement.
Although you've already conceded, the reasonable person would think that the underinsured coverage would do just as you suggested, that is, pay out if the driver or his shoe causes more damage than his or her liability coverage can cover, right?
Right. I believe they, as a general sense, they would expect that UIM coverage would apply in excess of liability coverage. And then coupled with the reference to the endorsement, the policy, the declarations page does advise to read the policy, and it's...
We have to read the endorsements, not just the policy.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. A lot of phrases under the declarations page. I can only go back to what I said before. At some point, it gets to be a question of how much do we put on there. When does the declarations page itself get to be ambiguous because there's so much on there you can't fathom through all of it?
That's a problem.
Thank you, Mr. Pliner.
Thank you, Justice.
Mr. Fowler, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
I'd like to keep my remarks confined strictly to rebuttal, and I don't think I'll require 5 minutes to do that, hopefully. I wrote down two points that I'd like to mention. Council has taken some issue, I think, with the the background and the reasons why this court and the courts of appeals have consistently held that the purpose of UIM coverage is to cover for damages that are not covered under the liability policy of the tortfeasor. I wondered why that's the case, and I began to talk a little bit about that earlier. In wondering about that, I took a look back in some of the cases that were cited and noted that in the Engstrom case, which was the first American Family definition of UIM vehicle I could find, it indicates that an underinsured motor vehicle means a motor vehicle which is insured by a liability bond or policy at the time of the accident, which provides bodily injury liability limits less than the damages an insured person is legally entitled to recover. That used to be the definition under the American Family policies of UIM coverage. That definition, of course, has been replaced over the past several years and now occurs in the form that's at issue in this case. It seems to me that that definition comports very well with what a reasonable insured would expect underinsured motorist coverage should be, but that definition isn't in the policy that we're dealing with here, and I'm not aware of any notice that American Family has ever drafted that would indicate that. So at least as a historical matter, the definition used to be used to define UIM coverage in regard to damages exceeding liability limits, but for some reason it doesn't do that anymore. And the final point I would simply make would be counsel indicated that in the cases I have raised where the court has gone beyond the definition of of an underinsured motor vehicle, which would be Hoagland and Link and Rohde, I think he indicated that the definitions were illegal. I pointed out in my brief that in Hoagland, of course, there was nothing illegal about the definition. It was the same definition basically we're dealing with here. In Link, the definition included a drive other cars definition, which the court easily went beyond. But I pointed out that there is nothing per se illegal about a drive other cars exclusion, as far as I can tell. I researched Wockert and the other cases that relate to it, and I'm not aware of any holding that a drive other car exclusion, or rather definition, is per se illegal when you're dealing with a single policy. It becomes a problem when you're dealing with multiple policies under 631.43 once you get to that issue. But as a threshold issue, as required in Kretsch, it's not illegal. Thank you for your attention to this case.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel. Now, the students will remain here, please. And Justice Prosser will be out shortly to discuss the processes and procedures that the court uses. Any